This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Death and dying is a topic that's often avoided. It's inevitable, as death may be. Most of us try not to think about our own death or the death of someone very close to us. Literally, palliative care refers to a care given to alleviate pain and anxiety, but that does not cure the disease. In reality, we tend only to use this terminology for the care that's given when death is close. Today, we'll talk with two people who have a great deal of experience in palliative care. Jane Burke is a clinical nurse consultant in palliative care with the Royal District Nursing Service, and Kate Williams is a counselling psychologist who has done a lot of work in the field of palliative care. Good morning to you both. Thank you for coming in.
Now, maybe we should sort of have a talk to each one of you sort of a little bit separately to start with. Jane, do you want to sort of give us a bit of a rundown? You're a nurse. You've got a nursing background, obviously.
Yes, I do.
Why palliative care?
Well, funnily, it was the last thing I thought I would ever actually get into. But when I started with the Royal District Nursing Service, I had the opportunity to branch into some cancer nursing. And that developed an interest in palliative care and went further on to do some studies, and it's where I've just found my passion in life.
Mm. And so, I mean, I guess to a lot of people that might sound like a strange passion.
Well, most people would say to me that it's a depressing job to be in, but personally I see it as a privilege, really, to be so involved in somebody's life. You know, you've never known them before, you never met them, you don't know anything about them or their family. And then all of a sudden you're just such a huge impact and such develop such close relationships in, you know, the most fragile, vulnerable time of their lives.
Mm. So, Jane, do you work outside of a hospital environment most of the time?
It's community-based home care nursing. So our aim is to support people who want to die at home, the clients, the family, and anyone that's involved in the care of them.
Mm. And now Kate Williams is a counselling psychologist. What made you get interested in this area of dealing with people who are dying, basically?
I think probably a bit similar to most of us, actually, and particularly Jane. You somehow find your way there, and once you've found your way there, you end up staying there. My particular involvement came about when I did my placement, when I was doing my postgraduate studies in psychology, and I applied to do my placement with Melbourne City Mission, and then after that fell in love with palliative care, and then after finally qualifying, sought employment in the area, and so worked with a few community-based organisations in palliative care.
So really, your counselling career started with palliative care, almost, if you were still doing postgrad stuff.
Yeah, anyone who's studying psychology and wanting to be a psychologist will know that your counselling career usually starts way back before then. You're doing lots of volunteer work, so I think drug and alcohol was probably where I began, but my passion really, when I got to choose, rather than it choosing me, I chose palliative care.
Mm. So, Jane, how many people, or would say the percentage of people, choose to die at home?
Well, the people that I see that come to our service, their first choice is to die at home. So home could be, you know, a caravan, a hostel. It could be anywhere that they call home. So we put everything in place to support them in that. But sometimes that doesn't always happen, but we always have other options available, to hospice and inpatient care are other options. But, you know, most people now would choose to die at home because we have such great supports that we can put in place for that to occur.
Yeah. As a psychologist, as someone who's dealing with that sort of emotional side of things, Kate, why do you think it is that so many people do seem to want to be at home when they're dying? What is it about home that...
Well, that's exactly it. What is it about home? Where do we all want to be when it's cold and wet, or if we're sad or lonely, or You know, home is the place that's most familiar to us. Home is the place where we generally, hopefully, feel safest in the world. And so when, at a time like that, I don't think anyone really enjoys being in hospital. And no matter how nice they can make any kind of institution, nobody really ever feels quite as comfortable as they do in their own home. And I think it's about the fact that being at home, it's easier to do things at the oddest times of the day. And so, yeah, we all prefer to be in our own home so we can make a cup of tea in the middle of the night.
Okay, yeah, it's a sort of a normalising, isn't it?
Yes,
the carer, definitely. Someone who died at home. I couldn't imagine actually just sitting in the hospital for hours and hours and hours, whereas at home, and we moved my partner out into the main living part of the house for several reasons, which I'll go into. But in retrospect, it was best to have her in the centre of the house rather than being locked away.
Yes,
so I could
definitely.
Be in the kitchen, which was a galley, and I could be cooking or on the phone, or we could both, well, I was going to say both watching TV, she probably wasn't, but I felt like we were both sitting and watching TV or relaxing. And that was just a really important time rather than people tiptoeing past the bedroom door.
Yes,
yeah. It sounds like you say, though, it's sort of being normal, isn't it?
Yeah,
as much as you can be. I think the worrying thing for me was that I knew that Jen wanted to die at home and I was supportive of that, but I actually had some fears around that I wasn't initially, I guess, expressing, because I didn't want to be the one that was saying this can't happen because it was obviously her choice and a very, very important thing. And then when I actually thought about it some more, what the fears were, my main anxiety was her dying in our bed, and it became clear actually that nursing in a normal bed is not the way to go. And then we got a proper hospital bed and shifted that out into the back room and made it into a lovely space. It was much, much better. And it's sort of interesting, the things that crop up for you, just about what's scary around it. And I actually wasn't scared of the dying bit. It was just, I don't know. But, yeah, there are ways around
it's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, I wonder how often we think about, when people are dying, how much do we think about what the impact of particularly dying at home is going to have on those people who are looking after that person and the people close to them and, the carers. Leanne has told me off air at different times the number of things that, you know, had to be thought about, the practical side of things, which I guess, Jane, do Royal District Nursing Service look after or help to look after some of those more practical things, like
Absolutely.
Getting the right sort of bed and...
Absolutely, yeah. We have access to all the services and supports to keep the client comfortable at home, so aids and equipment. We work very closely with the client's general practitioner, and we try and basically keep things very simple, try and enable the client and the family to be in control. And I think that's one good thing about being at home. It puts them more in control of the disease and more in control of the journey that they're on, rather than perhaps being in a bed in a hospital. So let them drive the care as much as possible for what's happening.
Yeah, I know for us it was around the, I guess, deterioration or the change in needs was quite rapid. So it went from needing sort of like things to help with toileting and showering through to things when she was bedridden and things like that, air mattresses and lifting hoists and just things, you know, even linen services and just amazing stuff that suddenly you find out about. But I found the palliative care team, the nurses, invaluable, getting sorted out the drugs that we needed.
Yes.
And as you said, working with GP, who was our GP, was there all the time for us, was happy to write scripts and obviously call in, and when Jen died was there immediately, that sort of thing.
Was the GP there for you as well as for your partner, Leanne?
Not so much in a, I guess, in a counselling sense. In the medical information or around that, I actually got from the palliative care team. And what I really appreciated was that the information they gave me was quite timely, that things that they were telling me, that obviously through experience knew what stages and things were at, and were only giving me the information that as I needed it. So like say towards the end, saying, well, you know, it's imminent, these are the actual signs of death to look for. And because it was imminent and I'd got my head around it, it wasn't frightening.
Yes.
Whereas if it had been a week before that, I probably wasn't ready to hear that information.
Yeah.
So it was very basic nuts and bolts, nitty-gritty discussions that we had to have.
And I think the timeliness of it is very important because it's all about preparing for the event.
Mm.
And a lot of the anxieties that people have is a fear of the unknown, really.
Yeah.
So it's really important that a lot of our time is spent educating and preparing so that, at the time people do feel a little bit more comfortable, a little bit more knowing about what is happening.
Mm. And I guess the preparation involves both the practical and the emotional preparation.
Yeah.
And we're speaking with Kate Williams and Jane Burke about palliative care, and we'll talk a little bit more about exactly what you do need to prepare yourself for, both in a practical and an emotional sense. Joy 94.9. You're listening to Saturday Magazine and Carol and Leanne with you. And that was
Ricky Lee Jones with Someone to Watch Over Me.
Oh, that was Ricky Lee.
Yeah. She's gone a bit when Cyndi Lauper did her quiet stuff. Ricky Lee did that. She's done some very interesting things in the last few years.
Hmm. Well, on Saturday Magazine, our In Focus topic today is palliative care. Now, we're speaking with Jane Burke and Kate Williams. Jane is a palliative care nurse and Kate is a counselling psychologist. Both are experienced in palliative care in their own sort of fields. And we've been talking about, we started to talk about some of the practicalities and of the sort of things that you might need to do if you're looking after a partner or a family member, someone close to you at home. What are some of the things that come to mind when you think about seeing someone who's dying? I'm thinking about the emotional stuff as well. What are the main things that actually affect people, do you think?
Well, I suppose the biggest thing that occurs for most of us is that we all come to these situations with our existing beliefs and values and ideas and thoughts about what death and dying might mean.
Mm.
And, that's going to be impacted by all sorts of things, such as people's religions or their culture, certainly the culture of their family of origin. We all come with our own ideas about and experiences of death and dying, and so that's going to really impact strongly on our own then personal experience of having someone close to us be in that situation or to be in that situation ourselves.
Kate, you've done a lot of counselling with people who are actually the patient, the person who is dying, as well as with partners and friends. How different is it counselling someone who knows that they are in fact dying who are fairly close to death?
Mm. It's interesting because it raises that whole question that we've always struggled with in palliative care, is who is the client?
Yes.
Is the client, and sort of Leanne was referring to that a little bit earlier, it's always difficult trying to know how to weigh up the needs of the family and carers as opposed to the person who has the disease and has the illness and is dying. So it's always an interesting kind of question. But how do you talk to someone who finds that that they are facing a life-threatening illness? It's very... again, it will be impacted very much by their own beliefs and their own understanding. And I suppose one of the first things that I always want to find out from someone to talk with them is what they understand about what's happening to them. What do they understand about their diagnosis? What do they understand about their illness? What do they understand about what may happen to them?
Do you find, either of you or both of you, do you find that generally people are often frightened of dying or frightened of the unknown?
I find, and I think I've heard it so many times in so many different arenas, people say, I'm not frightened of being dead, but I am frightened of what will lead up to to me dying, being dead. So it's that whole, the unknown of how much will I suffer?
Mm.
Will I suffer? How much will I suffer? Will I be able to cope with the suffering?
Mm.
And maybe Jane might be able to talk about this more, but what I discovered was pain management's probably the least of the worries. I mean, that's sort of easy in a sense that,
We can manage
quite
well.
Yeah.
Mm.
So
Not always, and the pain often is not just physical pain, it's the emotional pain and distress.
Yeah, I guess,
and that's the stuff
that
actually can't be medicated for.
True. Or articulated. I know in Jen's case she actually lost the ability to talk quite early on. So that's why I took on probably a more of a proactive role in that, and had to look after her needs. So you don't, it's not necessarily like the movie where someone's totally conscious and with it to the very end and is able to talk through all the things they ever wanted to talk through with everybody and, you know, go off with a clean slate. That's not necessarily
doesn't
the situation. So I guess
like
that's where that sort of more emotional pain comes in.
And Jane, I mean, you obviously, the Royal District Nursing Service, palliative care nurses would be looking after a lot of the very practical side of things. But you also manage all the emotions as well that go along with that.
Yes, we do. And I think that's the unique opportunity we have with home nursing, is the relationships that you develop not only with the client and the family are really quite special. And it also means that it's important that we do provide holistic care. So we're not just managing the physical and the medical components, is that we do have access to good pastoral care and bereavement supports that get started as early on as possible throughout the illness. And you know, other supports that are very common in palliative care, you know, to have occupational therapy and physiotherapy for aids and equipment. You know, the complementary therapies are very popular now, music therapy and art therapy. Volunteers, it's a whole team approach, really, because as we mentioned earlier, it's not always the physical pain that can be the issue. Often it's the spiritual pain that the client identifies as being, you know, much more important than the physical pain. So we need to be very aware of what the real needs are with such a diverse population that we see.
Kate, do you find that people do ask for counselling when they're dying? Is it something that more people perhaps should be asking for?
I'm not sure that it's whether people should or shouldn't. I suppose one of
I guess my question is more like, do people actually realise that there are people like yourself that that can provide that support? Is it something that just isn't known?
Well, yeah, I think hopefully, if the palliative care service that you're involved with is doing their job well, and if they're well resourced, which is often the problem, then that will be offered to you, and so it will continually be reoffered to you at different points in the care. So some people are very individual in the way in which they will deal with death and dying, and some people will be. Well, we've often had a saying that people will tend to die as they've lived. So if they've tended to be a non-talker or avail themselves of counselling or talking therapy, they're unlikely to kind of take it up in full force at that time of their lives. But if they have been the sort of person who's been happy to talk through the, you know, what's happened for them in their life, then, yeah, they'd probably be happy to take it up and continue living much as they have always done by talking and using talking therapy to help them deal with things in their lives.
And as far as, I guess, going back to those sort of practicalities, what is it that seems, I mean, I'm thinking, I had absolutely no idea about a lot of the things that Leanne, for example, had sort of mentioned. I sort of helped a partner sort of through a couple of bouts of breast cancer, and she's a survivor, which is great. But I can remember, like, the drug regime that we had even for that. The pool table just had drugs all over it, and we had a chart, you know. It's almost unthinkable what it must be like when you actually get to a stage where you're talking palliative care. Because I know what it was like just with chemotherapy and all the stuff that went along with that. And it's just almost unbelievable to sort of imagine that people have to cope with even more than that sort of regime that we were sort of going through. It must be amazing. What are the shocks that people get when you go in and say, well, you need this, you need that? What is it that... you find that people most don't know about, I guess? I'm thinking about the things that people don't know about that they might sort of go, wow, you know.
Yeah, medications, I suppose, can be lengthy, but again, we do simplify things a lot. So we work very closely with that. But it really is all about keeping things simple. And really, people do not know what they need, so they really do rely on us in giving them timely information about hospital beds, shower chairs, introducing other support services. So it can be very overwhelming initially, but I think the most important thing is that the earlier we get involved with the client and the family, then the better care that we can put in place and plan for the future. It's a better opportunity to develop those relationships.
I think too, human beings are remarkably adaptable. And the thing that we're often most frightened about is what we don't know about. But as long as we've been given support and information as we go along, so I suppose a lot of people say, oh, you know, I can't imagine ever having to wipe my dad's bum if he needs that, you know, and he would hate that and all that sort of thing. But and I guess it's amazing how we can actually adapt to that when needed.
And I guess that's the sort of thing that I'm thinking in terms of, you know, there must be things that hit you and you go, oh, I didn't realise I'm going to have to do that. And it must and I would imagine it's be a shock for both parties. You know, the person who is dying and the person who's caring for them. It must be like, hey, we've never been through this, down this track before. We've got an email that or text message that's just come in from Chris, and a couple of things that he's asking. What legal protection is there for carers if the actual death has any complications? He's put sort of suspicions, you know, but I mean, I guess, would that be something that... That wouldn't be something that would be happening that often, would it?
Oh, that sounds like it's alluding like to the whole kind of euthanasia sort of thing.
Yeah. It's not something that you guys tend to go down that track.
It obviously comes up in my work quite a lot, that question.
I suppose it does for both of you,
It does, and obviously legally we can't participate in that, but it does raise the question. Generally for palliative care, it's a process that doesn't involve any major dramas and catastrophes, and there's only certain scenarios where it might end up going to the coroner's court. But generally it's a process, and it's not something that raises a lot of legal or ethical questions about it.
Do you find, Kate, that when you are counselling people who are dying, that they do talk about that a lot, about wanting to die with dignity?
Not in my experience, not in my personal experience, but I tend to think that the sort of people that are likely to refer themselves to a palliative care service are not really necessarily looking for euthanasia or hastening their deaths. Certainly they're fearful, certainly they talk about the fear of how long will it be and what will it be like. And I think the euthanasia question usually comes up from the relatives and the families.
Okay.
Because they're the ones who are most distressed by having to watch someone suffer.
Yeah.
That's been my experience anyway.
Yeah, I agree. And I can see a good friend of mine who's a nurse, who was so helpful, and I couldn't got through it without her, advised me to write down when I administered drugs, not only because as fatigue set in, you just forget what you've done and the time, you know, doesn't mean anything anymore. But she also said it's a really good record. If you write down, actually have an extra column, not just time and what it was and amount, but the reason you did it, if there are things that you just give due to, I don't know, discomfort or whatever, because you've actually got a record then if something did happen, you've got a record of what was administered and what your reasons at the time were. Because I could see someone inadvertently even giving extra morph, for instance, by just being confused or upset or trying to not wait long enough for it to kick in and those sorts of things. So it wouldn't necessarily be a conscious thing. Or it might be. That's right. But it's at least if you're doing...
In palliative care, certainly as practitioners, we would record everything in the home and within the office environment. So there's usually a record of absolutely everything and why it was done in a particular way. So in that respect, so unless someone was intentionally doing something, then, yeah. But again, recording is a good idea.
Plus the other thing was that, I mean, we'd had the conversation earlier in the piece about not make it go on too long, and you know, I've had those discussions that you're not quite sure really till you get to it what that means.
Yeah.
People say they don't want to suffer, or I don't want to be on a machine, or I don't want to be a vegetable, you know, all those sorts of things you say in everyday conversation. But when you're at the time, it's a bit difficult. And Jen stopped taking things by mouth and then had to have her more intravenously. And then there was a point about whether she would have fluids or not, and we had to have the discussion about what that actually meant.
Yep.
And that's a prolonging a thing as well, and that's a very difficult decision to make, and I decided not to go that down that path, and that so she could die, I guess, naturally. But to be someone who makes a decision about whether someone's having fluids or not is a very difficult.
Hopefully you're well supported in that, and certainly my experience is that if difficult decisions need to be made, we get together with the medical practitioners who can give the family and everyone involved the information that they need to be able to make that decision.
Informed decision.
And certainly that, you know, you're never left to make that decision. Yes, it's your decision in the end, but we'll certainly make sure that you've got all the information that you need to feel comfortable with the decision that you make.
This is Saturday Magazine, and in focus today we're looking at palliative care. And we're speaking with Jane Burke and Kate Williams. Jane's a palliative care nurse and Kate's a counselling psychologist. We've been talking a lot about drugs, and I mean, I don't want to sound flippant, but I'm almost sort of thinking, if I was in that situation, I might need drugs myself as a carer.
Definitely.
I mean, you know, is it something that you find is an issue that people are saying, I need some sort of, I need medicating myself as a carer?
I think what we really do need to recognise is the coping capacity of the carer, and if we find that the carer is needing a break, we have options for respite care, whether that be in an inpatient facility or bringing somebody into the house to give that carer time out. You know, it's often, you know, that carer will be feeling depressed and tired and run down as well, and it's very important that we make sure that we deal with those scenarios, because if the care is not there, then the client doesn't meet their wish of being at home. So,
do you find that carers, though, sometimes do take on more than they should or are able to deal with?
If we're thinking about it, generally you'll find that that's probably going to be true, because generally carers are typically women, and women are really good at taking on more than they can.
That's true.
Yeah. So without being gendered about that, I think that's typically true. But even men, I mean, I think we all want to give people that we're caring for the best that we can give them. So we'll generally push them ourselves a little bit too far. So most services are very mindful of the fact that the carer is very important in this process. Home care could not occur without a home carer. So we're very focused on making sure that the carer gets the care that they need to be able to provide the care.
Do you think that people actually know what they're getting into when they agree to?
No. Do we ever know what we're getting into in life when we agree to do things?
You know, for me, it was I could cope all the way along. I mean, even though I was exhausted, it was afterwards what to do with that energy. It's because you don't just obviously stop. Yeah. So, I mean, I had, like, the cleanest house for for months, because I was still waking up at 4
That's
o'clock
common.
In the morning and, you know, doing the skirting boards with toothbrushes. And oh, no, seriously, because I just had, like, all this pent-up sort of everything, I guess.
It's possibly also how you were managing your grief.
Oh, I think it was, definitely. Yeah, I was so fit. Gym every 5 minutes.
I remember.
Yes.
Okay, just we need to sort of wind up. What if someone is in a situation at any time in the future where they need to access palliative care, both from an emotional and a psychological and a practical point of view? What's the best thing for them to do, as far as, say, well, from an emotional side of things, perhaps first, Kate?
I think the thing that I was thinking as you're talking, Carol, is that that we just continue to reassure people, don't never be afraid to ask questions. The only stupid question they say is the question you don't ask. You know, your GP is always, of course, the first port of call for most people in any situation, and they generally should have the information to be able to refer people on. If you're getting to that stage, you've probably already been involved with certain organisations anyway. So it's just don't be afraid to ask, and don't be afraid of your own fears as well. Yeah, it's the unknown that people are worried about. So if you talk to people, you reach out. Don't do this on. You don't have to do this on your own.
Mm. And it's okay to be afraid.
It's normal. It's everybody is. Mm. Yeah. It's perfectly normal. You'd be, if you weren't afraid, there'd be something. I'd be worried about you.
Yeah,
yeah.
And Jane, as far as say, Royal District Nursing Service and the sort of perhaps the more practical as well side of palliative care. Where's the first port of call through your GP?
Well, you can make a referral to our service yourself, a family member, a GP, the neighbour, anybody can make a referral. Mm. And I can leave those details with you if you like for our referral line. Mm. So once that process is done, then you'll be contacted by one of our palliative care nurses and we will come out and meet you and formulate a plan of care and you will drive the care from there on. We will be involved as little or as much as you want us to be.
Mm. Mm. So it sounds as though it's something that both of you, you know, you said when we first started talking that you kind of fell into it in a sense, the palliative care side of your work. And yet it's something that you're really quite passionate about and you really enjoy. It's quite amazing, isn't it, that a topic that is, I guess, rarely spoken about and which is, in a sense, so very... I suppose there's even a bit of taboo about
it,
really.
Absolutely.
Can make... Because you're not the first people that I've spoken to, actually, that have said, worked in palliative care and worked with the dying, who said... Yeah, this is fabulous. It's really fabulous work.
I've often likened it to my experiences of being at births, and I've had the privilege of being at a couple of my sister's births, and it's felt a similar kind of privilege. It's the privilege of being there as someone comes into life and the privilege of being able to help them out of life.
Mm.
And it's one of those things. If you haven't done it, you don't really understand it. But once you've done it, you have a better understanding of what that means.
Mm. Well, I guess as a nurse, Jane, that would be something that you've experienced as well, being at births.
Yes, I have, a long time ago in my training. But there's actually been a lot of research comparing, you know, the work of midwives and the work of palliative care nurses over the years and for those reasons.
Mm.
So it's just an area that, you know, I feel very comfortable in.
That sounds wonderful. This is Saturday Magazine and we've been speaking with Kate Williams and Jane Burke, and both of them work in palliative care. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak with them, hasn't it, Leanne?
Oh, yeah, and I can't thank the palliative care team that I was involved with enough. I mean, I obviously couldn't have done it without them, so good
on
you.
They couldn't do it without you either.
No, it was a win-win. So.
Yeah, and it's all we've got time for, I'm afraid, but thank you very much to all our guests today, but particularly this last hour for Jane and Kate, who've been talking to us about palliative care.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.